Good morning, Jesus lovers. When I was in junior high, my family decided to renovate and add on to our house. It was a huge project, and more so because, as Sutherlands do, we did almost all the work ourselves. Took many years. It wasn't until college till we finished. But one of the last things that we did, the last thing once the whole house was done, is we built this like concrete path around the whole house to walk on and for protection of the foundation, all that jazz. And so every weekend, me and my dad would pour a section of concrete. We did like these four-foot square sections at a time, and we just slowly every weekend went around the house. But there was this one weekend, and my dad wasn't in town, and he asked me if I could prepare the ground for the next section of concrete. The ground was a little high, and he asked me to dig it out so that the shape of the ground was ready for the pouring of concrete for the next weekend. I had a friend over, and I asked my friend, "Hey, can you help me dig this hole? I'd really appreciate the help," because my dad asked me if I could dig a 4-foot hole for him. And that's pretty deep. And my friend was willing, and so we got the shovels out, and we started digging. And, you know, if you've ever dug, it goes down quickly at first. The ground was pretty soft, and we start to dig down. We get down maybe a foot or so, and we hit some really, really hard ground. And our shovels are just bouncing off the ground. And it's like, great. So then we go get the pickaxe, and we're swinging the pickaxe, trying to break up this really tough ground. We end up chipping the previous square concrete, which we got in trouble for that later, but we're picking and we're digging deeper and deeper, and I swing the pickaxe and then shoveling it out, and I'm starting to think, as you know, a couple hours now, me and my friend out in the backyard, I'm like, I don't remember digging quite this deep for the last few sections. This seems to be a whole lot deeper than what we need to do to build a little concrete walkway. And so after a couple hours, it's like, okay, Jeremy, I'm going to call my dad because I think we're doing something wrong. And so I called my dad, and I asked my dad, how deep were we supposed to dig again? And he said 4 inches. It was such a bummer. A 10-minute job that would have taken 10 minutes for 4 inches of soil. We were out there for hours trying to dig to 4 feet. And then we had to put all the dirt back in and tamp it back down so it was solid enough so the concrete patch wouldn't sink when we poured the foundation. All because I didn't listen very well. My dad said 4 inches, and I heard 4 feet. I don't listen well, and my wife can probably attest to that. But it's not just me. I think this is somewhat general of humanity. Humans don't always listen very well. I'm not talking about hearing loss. I'm talking about the ability to listen well and to comprehend the words that are being said. And this happens all over in life, that we don't remember movie quotes, we don't remember song lyrics very well. Vader never said, "Luke, I am your father." James T. Kirk never said, "Beam me up, Scotty." Marie Antoinette never said, "Let them eat cake." Taylor Swift doesn't sing about lonely Starbucks lovers. And Sting didn't sing about a year passing since he broke his nose. He should have blown it right from the start. That communication is so important. It is so important to communicate clearly, to communicate ideas in such a way that they are not left open for misinterpretation. And when it comes to talking about the good news of Jesus, when it comes about sharing our faith, it is absolutely vital that we speak in such a way that it is clearly understood by those we are speaking to. That if anything is so important, is that how do we communicate Jesus, his death and his resurrection, in such a way that it is clearly understood, even if someone doesn't believe in it, but that they can clearly understood and repeat back a few days later. That's what Christians believe. If you were to share the story of Jesus with someone, if you were to share the gospel, the good news, could that person a couple days later give an accurate summary of what you said? And this is what I want us to think through this morning, because we're going to see Paul clearly communicate the good news, that he is going to clearly communicate the good news of Jesus, the message of Jesus, in such a way that someone who doesn't understand Christianity and who, as far as we know, never becomes a Christian, is at least able to clearly understand, okay, I've got a frame on what is Christianity. That if we were on the stand, as we'll see Paul on the stand today, could we communicate the basic truths of Christianity? That's what I want us to really wrestle with this morning, that when we think, what does it look like to communicate Jesus? What is the most important thing? What is the world learning around us for what it means to take this title, this label, to be a Christian. And so let's open up to God's word. And my prayer is that as we dive in, that we just, we see Paul sharing clearly and we see what it looks like to keep the main things, the main things. So let's open up to Acts chapter 25. And we're going to read most of this chapter today. Acts chapter 25, and we're starting in verse 1. Acts 25, verse 1. Here is the word of the Lord. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. And they requested Festus, as a favor to them, to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can press charges against him there." Now we are now meeting this character named Festus. He is the new Roman governor of the region of Israel. And just to quickly remind you from last week, Ken shared last week that Paul is in prison and there's a previous Roman governor named Felix. And how Felix kept him in prison for 2 years without any resolution to his case. It was a really good sermon. If you didn't listen last week, I highly encourage you, go back, listen on YouTube or on our website. If you want to hear Ken speak in 2x speed, YouTube has that option. Just fun fact. Felix, though, as Ken shared last week, Felix couldn't handle the truth. And so he cowardly leaves Paul in prison when he leaves office, even though he knows Paul is innocent. And now there's a new governor. Same first letter, kind of mixes it up. But Felix and now Festus. That he is the governor, and the Jewish leaders are absolutely relentless. You think that after 2 years, they would have cooled off some of their anger against Paul. But the very first thing on their agenda, as soon as we get a new governor, what's the first thing that we're going to tell them about? Can we kill this prisoner named Paul? It's crazy. Like, this is the first thing on their agenda. You think about like the political, religious interplay in a tenuous state. Like the first thing that they're going to ask is, can you murder this prisoner for us? Like that's still so prominent in their minds that they want Paul gone so badly. And 2 years passes by and this is still number one on their agenda. They want him gone and here is a new opportunity. And they've already got the plan. It's the same plan from chapter 23, right? The ambush plan. It's here's a new governor. He knows nothing of our previous request to get Paul in the move, to get him traveling, get him out in the open so we can kill him. So let's try the ambush plan again. And you think about those men in chapter 23, they haven't eaten in 2 years now. They're probably getting terribly hungry just waiting on the side of the road. I'm just kidding. Although I wouldn't be terribly surprised if the same men were involved in the plot 2 years later. I'm sure that it's the same group of people that want Paul out of the way. And once again, this plan doesn't work. God is keeping Paul safe. And Festus unknowingly protects Paul for simply pragmatic reasons. Like Festus has no idea of the plot. He has no idea what would happen if he moved Paul. But I'm sure in his Roman authority, who are these Jews telling me what to do? If you've got a case, you come to me. I'm not coming to you to solve your problems. If you want to solve this problem, you've got to come to me in my capital city of Caesarea. That's where my palace is. You want to deal with the problem? You come deal with me. And yet, in the midst of this unknowing protection, right, God's sovereign hand is at work, guiding and leading the affairs of man, where we see God sovereignly in control and humans' freedom in the decisions that they make in this perfect interchange. And Paul is protected because God made a promise. Paul is getting to Rome. And so the Jewish leaders, they take up Festus on his request and they follow him back to Caesarea. And let's read that encounter, verse 6. After spending 8 or 10 days with them, Festus went down to Caesarea. The next day he convened the court in order that Paul be brought before him. When Paul came in, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him. They brought many serious charges against him, but they could not prove them. Then Paul made his defense. "I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple or against Caesar." Now, here is, once again, if you're getting tired of these courtroom scenes, I think Luke is too, because here is another courtroom scene, which probably was a big affair, and Luke summarizes it in three simple verses. Like, this is like the bare minimum report of what happened in a new court case, in a new courtroom scene between Paul and the Roman leader. That the Jewish leaders make the same exact claims against Paul that they've been making, and Luke's just summarizing it, right? That they brought many serious charges against them, but they could not prove him. Just a one-sentence summary. This is the same charges that Paul has been dealing with from these Jewish leaders. And then Paul responds the same defense, and I think that this is a summary because in chapters 22, 23, and 24, we see Paul's longer defense, and it seems like these are the same charges and the same exact defense that Paul would be making now to the new leader of Festus. But I just want to highlight, just recognize this, that these charges, because Luke makes it clear in Paul's one-sentence summary of these are the charges against Paul in verse 8. I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law, or against the temple, or against Caesar. All right, these three charges that Paul has to answer, two of them religious, one of them political, that Paul is blaspheming against the two most important things in Judaism, according to the Jewish leaders. He's blaspheming against the law, the Mosaic law, and the temple. But the ultimate charge, the one that the Roman governor would care about, and we've looked at this in the past, is that this charge that he is in rebellion against the Roman Empire, or rebellion against Caesar. That if Jesus is Lord, this proclamation of Jesus being Lord is in direct violation of Roman law, which only Caesar is Lord. That this is the one that Jewish leaders probably think, this is the one that's going to get the new governor on our side, right? We're going to take care of Paul by making these charges against him. And yet Paul makes his defense, like in the same summary, I'm sure, of the same things he's been repeating over and over again. And so how is Festus going to respond? Right, will he respond differently than the other Roman leaders that Paul has dealt with? Verse 9. Festus, willing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges?" Paul answered, "I am now standing before Caesar's court where I ought to be tried. I have not done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar you will go." And that here in this moment, Paul has simply said, "I'm done. I have had enough with this situation. I have been in prison now for too long with nothing happening. With new Roman leadership, a new governor, Festus is going to end up doing the same exact thing that Felix did. Keep delaying the procedure to try to curry favor with the Jewish leaders." And Paul says, "Fine, I'm done. If I can't get justice from the Roman leaders, then I'm going to go above their heads. If they're not going to do their job to adjudicate this case, I am appealing my case." And in Roman law, Roman citizens had this right. The word is provocatio. I think that's how you pronounce it. But it was an appeal court, if you will, for Roman citizens. In the same way that, not in the same way, but how our justice system has an appellate court. Same idea that you can appeal cases. And there are a couple different ways that under Roman law a citizen could appeal their case. And Paul takes one of the ways you could appeal your case, which is appealing to the Caesar, right? Going straight to the top. He's saying, and under this Roman law, you could say before a judgment has been declared, so before there's any sort of local justice, I'm just going to appeal straight to the top. Take my case and leapfrog everything. And it was a Roman right for Roman citizens. And Paul, I don't know if in these 2 years he's learning Roman law, or I don't know how he found out about it, or maybe he's always known about it, but he says, "I've had enough. Like, I am just going to take this case all the way to the top." That there is absolutely no reason, Paul says, to go back to Jerusalem. There's no reason for Festus to move this trial. He's already in the palace with the Roman governor in the right spot for a court case. There'd be absolutely no reason to go back to Jerusalem. And I think it's implicit in verse 11, right? At the end of the verse, he says, "But if these charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them." And I think Paul knows very well that if this case goes back to Jerusalem, there's probably going to be another attempt on his life. That if he is released, if you will, from the Roman court system to move to a Jewish court system, it's not going to end well. It is in effect, de facto, Roman governor handing him over to be murdered by the Jewish leaders. And Paul says, I'm out of here. I am appealing to Caesar. And just like last week, we see the Roman governor shirking their judicial responsibility. And Luke tells us why, right? In verse 9, Festus wishing to do the Jews a favor. That this, just like Felix and just like most unfortunate leadership people, that they would rather curry favor than do what is right and uphold justice. But for Festus now, with Paul appealing his case, I think it's probably a good thing for Festus. He's like, I'm washing my hands of this. I'm done. It's going to go beyond me. I can live at peace in my new governorship. The problem is, if you will, running out of town. Feel free to get out of my hair, Festus says. And so he confers with his council and says, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go. And that this is the facts of the case, if you will. But what we see, right, through it all, through all of these action and years of history happening, is that God's will is coming true. That God told Paul he's getting to Rome, and here is how Paul gets to Rome. I mean, basically, you could say Paul got himself to Rome. He used his legal rights. He understood the legal law of the time and uses it to get to Rome. Now, Paul says, I know the Lord's will. I know that this is the Lord's will for me, and here is a way that I can carry out the will of the Lord by claiming this legal right that he has to appeal to Caesar. In spite of all the political maneuvering of the Roman leadership and of the Jewish leadership, Paul finds a way to carry out the will of God. But this story of Festus ends with this next section. I think it's so important. So let's read this, verse 13 through the end of this section. A few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He said, there is a prisoner here whom Felix left as a prisoner. When I went to Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him and asked that he be condemned. I told them that it is not the Roman custom to hand over anyone before they have effaced their accusers and have had an opportunity to defend themselves against the charges. When they came here with me, I did not delay the case, but convened the court the next day and ordered the man to be brought in. When his accusers got up to speak, they did not charge him with any of the crimes I had expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus who Paul claimed was alive. I was at a loss how to investigate such matters, so I asked if he would be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial there on these charges. But when Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him held until I could send him to Caesar. And then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear this man myself. He replied, tomorrow you will hear him. That Festus talks to a new character named King Agrippa. Full name would be King Herod Agrippa II. This is the sixth Herod mentioned in the Bible, a very popular family that had a lot of power for many years in Israel and beyond. We're gonna look at him a lot more next week, so I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to focus on Agrippa II today because I want to keep the focus on Festus. I think this whole section is about Festus, the emphasis. And that this whole section is basically like we get an internal insight into the mind of Festus. That as he's sharing his thoughts with Agrippa II, as he's telling him the case, we learn about how Festus is responding to this situation. It's basically a recap of what Luke has already told us in the previous section of this chapter. But I want to highlight a couple revealing verses that take us into Festus's mind, verses 18 and 19. I mean, listen, this is what Festus says. When his accusers got up to speak, they did not charge him with any of the crimes I had expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus who Paul claimed was alive. Two things. The first, Festus recognizes this is clearly a religious dispute. This isn't political. This has nothing to do with the Roman Empire. It has nothing to do with the claim against Caesar that Christianity is in no way, shape, or form a threat to the Roman Empire, which is true. And the second is this, and I love this. Look how Festus describes Christianity. A dead man named Jesus, who Paul claimed was alive. A dead man named Jesus, who Paul claimed was alive. Don't you just love that description of Christianity? Hearing a non-Christian describe Christianity this way? That what Festus is taking, he had this courtroom scene. Luke doesn't give us all the details, but I'm sure a lot of sharing back and forth. Paul is probably doing a lot more talking than the one line that Luke gives us. And that after that whole courtroom scene, when Festus sits down and the next day or the next couple days later, a few days later, when he has to give an account and a report and an understanding of what this is all about, it is the fact that Paul is claiming some dead man is alive. And then I started this morning just talking about how people don't always understand and comprehend things super well, which is why it's so important to communicate clearly. And I think right here, we see the language of someone who probably, who does not understand Christianity at all, who doesn't know all the finer points. But after hearing Paul present it, he gets the main issue. There is a dead man who Paul claimed was alive. That's Christianity. That is Christianity for someone who maybe doesn't know all of the lingo. A dead man is alive. A man who we would say is actually a God-man. And that if we had to share Jesus, could the person that we are talking to give an adequate description later? Would they say, yeah, that person was a Christian, and they believe that a dead man is alive? And that this is the most important thing to get across. And I think it comes out so clearly every time Paul speaks in the book of Acts, every single time, every speech that he gives in the book of Acts, which is last one, will be chapter 26 next week, he always finds a way to get to the resurrection. He takes wherever he's talking about, whoever he's talking to, and he finds some way, some pathway, some line of reasoning to end up at the resurrection, that a dead man is now alive. Now, I think this word resurrection, it is a great word. It is definitely the most precise word. It is the biblical word. But I would rather someone who hears me talk about Jesus say, yeah, he thinks some dead man is alive, than to say, yeah, he believes in a resurrection. Like, it's not so much the word, although the word is great. It's obviously a great word. But I care more about communicating clearly the message of Jesus than using maybe the precise, technical, right words. And I love it so much that Festus's summary of Christianity is a dead man who Paul claimed was alive. Don't you realize how incredible that claim is? That claim, that story, that historical reality changes everything. Because there is something about that story that grabs the human heart, that hits us at our deepest parts of what it means to be human. It sticks with humanity. There's this really famous essay that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote. He's the author of The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings. Great books, great movie. But he wrote this essay, and it's titled On Fairy Stories. And Tolkien, who is kind of the pioneer, if you will, of the fantasy genre, he's one of the first to actually write fantasy, like putting stories in completely different universes with rules that look nothing like our universe. And so he wrote this paper. It's very, very academic paper. And he's trying, it's a very English paper, very trying to delineate, this is what a fairy tale is. He's responding to critics, and he's just describing this genre of what it looks like to set a story in another universe. But Tolkien makes such an insightful observation at the end of his paper that he ends this very academic English major type paper by making this observation about humanity. That he wrote that at the end of his essay that there are deep longings in the human heart that realistic fiction cannot satisfy. That realistic fiction, right, writing a fictional story in our universe doesn't satisfy. And the reason why he says is this. That the reason, this is a paraphrase, not a quote, but he says that the reason that fantasy, fairy tale, science fiction, and literature like it is so gripping is because it depicts characters who get outside of time, who escape death, who hold communion with non-human beings, find perfect love, and triumph over evil. It is these themes that make fairy tales, that make the fantasy realm so popular. And Tolkien ends it by saying this, that the reason these stories with these themes resonate so deeply is because it bears witness to an underlying reality. It's because this is what humanity is actually longing for. That even non-Christians sense that these sorts of things characterize life as it was, as it should be, and as it will be one day. That we will have communion with non-humans. That we will escape time and death. That there are fantastic worlds with more dimensions than the ones that we know. That there is a final defeat of death. That these are the natural longings of the human heart. And the reason fantasy worlds capture it so much better than realistic fiction is because it's true. Because it's actually reality. And this is why Festus can make this claim. Because there's just something weird and unusual about the idea that there is a dead man who is now alive. That's not how life normally goes. It's so wild, so fantastic, and yet it's the thing that inwardly we long for as humans. And we know this is true. We love the fantasy realm. Let me give you another literary example. The Avengers. Literally the most popular and successful cinematic franchise in history. It's a fantasy. It's set in another universe. It doesn't operate like the universe that we know. And yet, after 23 movies, what is the final victory? How do they defeat evil? What is the only way in 14,605 possibilities that the Avengers can defeat Thanos? Someone has to sacrifice and lay down their life. I am Iron Man. Victory. What we see and long for in fantasy is the reality of the underlying desires of the human heart. A dead man named Jesus laid down his life for his friends. And unlike Iron Man, but like Gandalf, he does come back to life. We follow a God who came back to life. That's the heart of Christianity. That's the focus. That's the main thing. Do we actually know this Jesus? And I think as Paul is sharing his story, and it's not recorded what he says, but I think it comes across so clearly. Paul seems to talk about this Jesus like he knows him. It's not just a claim. It's the fact that he talks about this Jesus like he met him, like he experienced him. Do we talk about Jesus the same way? Do we talk about Jesus like we actually know him? Like he's actually real? Or do we just talk about it like it's just another world religion that's called Christianity? And I would say this, it is not about our views on morality. It's not about our position on some theological tenets. It's not about a certain worldview in a way that we view the world. It's about actually knowing and walking and experiencing the God-man Jesus. A real, historical, still living person who is the most amazing being in the universe. Someone you actually know. Is Jesus real to you? Is he someone that you can say is my Lord and my Savior and my friend? That I communicate with him like I communicate with other people? That I do things with him? That I do things for him? That I am walking with him day in and day out? Can you talk about Jesus as well as you can talk about a family member or your best friend? When people hear you talk about Jesus, is there at least some level of intrigue because you're talking about him like he's real? Like you actually know him? I'm not saying that other stuff isn't important. Theology matters. Morality matters. Biblical worldview matters. We should be experts in knowing the contents of this book. But only because we actually know Jesus and are walking with him. Look at Paul. Right? Paul is a theological stud. He wrote 13 books of the New Testament. Quite the honor. But that's not what Festus notices about him. Paul talks about this dead guy who he seems to know, and that Paul claims to have come back to life. That's what Festus picks up about Christianity. It's the same thing that the Jews noticed about Peter and John in chapter 4. And describe in chapter 4, right, this amazing line, that they were amazed that Peter and John had been with Jesus. They knew him, and the courage that they were displaying didn't come from their schooling, it didn't come from their prestige. Their courage came because they knew Jesus. I grew up in a very Christian home. I'm very thankful that my parents loved the Lord, and from a young age, they taught me and my siblings Jesus. As a kid, I knew the Bible, I knew theological truths about God, I knew the theological jargon, if you will. But it's when I actually met Jesus at a summer camp in junior high and actually got to know and understand and actually experience Jesus in creation and in worship, and that there was a creator God who loved me and sacrificed for me. And I wanted nothing more than to know and follow him. That my previous knowledge, well, I'm so thankful for my parents and the way that they raised me, but that previous knowledge no longer were just mental facts that I knew. Right? They became greater knowledge and relationship with the God who loved me and who I wanted to love and serve back. And in the last 16 years of following Jesus since that moment, I have continued to experience and know God more and more. The God-man who I know is still alive, and who, as much as I learn facts about him and the way that he built this universe, I want so much more to walk in that sweet communion with him. That we just sang this morning, right? Such an awesome God. Nothing comes close to the Lord Almighty. Nothing as sweet as his love and mercy, right? That experiential walking with Jesus, that I can make a claim. Jesus is alive, and I know his love and his mercy. When I think about the church, right, the global church, God's bride on this earth, how do I want the world to see the church? I want the world to look at the church and be forced to contend with Jesus. Man, they won't shut up about this dead guy they claim is alive and that they claim to know. That they are so enraptured with Jesus of Nazareth. Let the culture around us hate us. That's fine. They'll hate us because they hate Jesus. But I want them to hate us for our love for Jesus, not because of something else. That if we keep the main thing, if we talk about Jesus and make claims that he is dead and he was dead and he rose again, that's what I want the world to see. That when they look at the church, when they look at Christians as a whole, as a block, whatever you may be, like, man, they want Jesus. That this is the central tenet of Christianity. And as I read this story this morning, as we just read it collectively, I hope in my prayer, what I've just been wrestling with this week is that I just want Jesus. I want to experience him. I want to know him. I want to talk about him in the way that Paul talks about him. That a non-Christian will respond by saying, hey, wow, they're making some remarkable claims. Maybe claims that maybe grab something underlying about the human condition and the human heart. Now, I can't force you. No preacher can force anybody to love Jesus. But what I do is just speak of the magnificence and the beauty and the awe and the wonder of who Jesus is. A God who satisfies every longing of your soul when nothing else can. That there is no drug on this planet. There is no amount of success that you can find. There is no amount of sex that will ever satisfy. But Jesus of Nazareth can. That we're going to sing right now. We're going to sing a final song. And I just want you guys, I want all of us, me first, all of us, sing it to Jesus. Sing it to a God who is actually real. As if you're actually talking to someone. As if he is actually alive, because he is. And that he cares for you more than you can know. That this idea of musical worship is so wonderful because it helps us dig deep into what it means to be human, our deepest levels, and to cry out the cries of our hearts to a God in a way that is just, we're wired for music. Even if we're terrible at it, we're still wired to sing praises, to be lyrical, to grab the emotional side of us to say, I actually know this God, and I want to talk to him. So the worship team's going to come back up. And I might be like, let's blow the roof off with our voices. Not literally, of course, that's impossible. But that the presence of God, Jesus of Nazareth, is here in this room operating because he is alive. And we get the amazing, beautiful opportunity to sing to a God who saves. The lover of our soul who died. And we make the claim, because it's true, that he came back to life. So let's sing. Let's sing to a God who is real.